I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In the news this week, Asplund Tree experts based in Willow Grove agreed to pay $95 million and plead guilty for repeatedly hiring workers without authorization to be in the United States. Separately, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement made 107 arrests in Philadelphia last week for federal immigration violations. Joining me with perspective is Peter Pedamonte, co-founder and director of New Sanctuary Movement of Philadelphia, which works in part to track immigration enforcement. Peter, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Describe in a more general sense the work of your organization and in large measure helping to craft Philadelphia's current sanctuary status.
Sure. So we are an interfaith immigrant justice organization, and we work with 26 congregations across the city. And half of them are immigrant communities, the other half are non-immigrant, really coming together to live out our faith values, to welcome the stranger and love our neighbor, and create a city that's more welcoming and more just. So we were part of a coalition with other groups in the city that passed Philadelphia Sanctuary City Policy in 2014, which at the time was one of the best policies in the country. And what it does is it restricts the collaboration between Philadelphia police and immigration. And what we've seen is that it's a really solid policy. It reduces deportations and keeps families together. It makes us safer. People trust the city and police more. It also has helped build our city for immigrant communities and for everybody. For example, we have members who are small business owners. And they used to, before this policy, they would sell food in a, out of a cooler in a shopping cart. But every time a police officer drove by, they'd be very nervous because they knew Philly was collaborating with ICE. After this policy, what we saw is that they weren't scared of the police and also had trust in the city. So they registered their business. They were able to grow their business and hire another person and buy a food truck. I think what we're seeing is that this policy helps the economy grow as well.
Though, to what extent has that trust been newly compromised with the developments cited this week?
Exactly. I think this operation by ICE is really brutal. I mean, it really feels like retaliation. What I believe is that these policies across the country were having an impact and were reducing deportations, and so ICE has been fighting them for a while. And this started before Trump. Under the Obama administration, the Department of Homeland Security was meeting with former Mayor Nutter and mayors across the country, pushing them and putting a good amount of pressure on them to change these policies. Under the Trump administration, what we're seeing is an escalation of those tactics to something as cruel this week, where a lot of our members feel like it's psychological warfare. They're really spreading terror in the community.
Though ICE says they are prioritizing aliens with criminal convictions, and on the face of it, many would say, go for it.
Mm-hmm. So we don't believe that. I mean, despite what they're using for their public relations, the policy says they can take anyone they want. And the new priorities that Trump set up in his executive orders say that ICE can deport anyone.
It's discretionary completely.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see your efforts appropriately marshaled next? What's the priority?
We collected, over 3,000 petitions and delivered them to Mayor Kenney last week. We've also held 4 prayer vigils across the city to remember the people who have been arrested in raids, in the last year. And we've seen more people than ever coming out to do really solid work, not just showing up for one protest, but doing the day in and day out work that it's going to take to really change things. And I think that gives me hope. That gives me strength. So this last week, we've gotten many calls on the phone, but they unfortunately have been after the fact with people reporting. When that happens, we support people in 2 different ways. One is to really accompany them. So we make sure they have a lawyer. We make sure we help them find their loved one. And then we have people who walk with them, surrounded with community. So members will either go to court with them with 5-10 people, or visit people in detention. And when we go to court, what that does is, first and foremost, it just surrounds someone with community. Second, it makes sure that the judge and the court knows that we're watching.
We're talking about 107 arrests last week, but you mentioned arrests over the whole year. Around how many arrests were made?
So we get a pretty steady flow of people coming to the office or calling, saying, their spouse has been picked up, their brother has been picked up, their son has been picked up. And so we probably get 4 to 6 a month calls. And of course, there's spikes and low points. But I definitely noticed when there's an operation, like shortly after the administration came in, there was a big spike during an operation that ICE did. You know, ICE is doing their work every day. And so, you know, we usually get about 4 to 6 calls a month. So there's a big spike this last week, Sunday through Wednesday. We had, you know, probably 15 to 20 calls about people.
Peter Pedamonte, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
Peter Pedamonte, co-founder and director of New Sanctuary Movement of Philadelphia. The latest failure of Republicans to pass their long-promised repeal of the Affordable Care Act has sparked a debate in the party over what to do next. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports that Republicans from our region are once again taking the lead on a plan to stabilize the insurance market.
South Jersey Republican Tom MacArthur put his neck out when he teamed up with far-right conservatives to reach the deal that got an Obamacare repeal bill passed in the House. So he was a bit deflated when the Senate came up short this week.
Well, I'm disappointed because it's a lost opportunity.
MacArthur says there were flaws in the Senate bill that turned Obamacare funding over to the states to spend as block grants. He also admits his bill that could have weakened some Obamacare protections for people with pre-existing conditions wasn't perfect either. But MacArthur says they were both better than the status quo.
But look, there are plenty of flaws in both the House and the Senate bill,
yeah,
including the one that I was involved in. And there are flaws in that bill. And there are things that now I guess we take a deep breath, we go back, and we try to think about what are the objectives.
MacArthur says his goals have always been fairly simple.
That everyone in the country should have some form of insurance. I've always said that. Some form of insurance. That's one goal. Two, that we bring down health care costs. All of this is for naught if we don't actually bend the health care cost curve.
But the GOP is at a crossroads. Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price has been accused of trying to undercut the law by dramatically scaling back outreach and advertising to get more people to enroll for Obamacare coverage. And President Trump has previously called for his party to just let the law collapse. Republican Congressman Ryan Costello, who represents parts of 4 counties west of Philadelphia, says that's the wrong approach.
No, I think that's deeply problematic because that's a political argument, and we're talking about families and businesses needing assurances and a sense of confidence that the health insurance marketplace is going to function next year.
Costello is a member of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus, which has floated its own proposal to stabilize the law. It calls for a variety of approaches, like creating a stability fund to help states lower premiums, while also permanently repealing an unpopular tax on medical devices. It also would give states more flexibility to innovate and bring costs down, according to Costello.
I think that the problem solvers assembling that creates a responsible vehicle by which to stabilize it for the coming year. I believe the Senate is now looking at that, and that may be in large measure what a bipartisan bill out of the Senate would look like.
But many Republicans don't like the sound of that. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham was one of the lead authors of the last failed Senate proposal, and he says the problem solver's bipartisan proposal sounds like a bailout for insurance companies.
I'm not going to take more money and give it to insurance companies. The one thing I've learned, if giving money to insurance companies would provide you with better health care, we'd have great health care.
But Congressman Charlie Dent from Lehigh Valley says his fellow Republicans like Graham have learned nothing if they continue to pass a GOP-only bill. Dent, who's retiring after this term, says Democrats need to be at the table now, too.
So that's where we should start this discussion. We always knew that if we were trying to jam health care reform through on a partisan basis, we'd have the same kind of problems that Democrats had. But we need a durable, sustainable reform, so we need to move on a bipartisan basis, center out, and do this incrementally.
Dent says the status quo is unacceptable, and he's hoping GOP leaders will take up the bipartisan problem solvers bill that also funds Obamacare subsidies in the interim.
I mean, there are so many serious flaws with the health care law, Obamacare. We all know that. And there are parts of this law, I've always said, that need to be repealed, parts of it replaced, parts of it repaired, overhauled, and retained. And so I think that the approach we've taken, again, is incremental in nature. It deals with the immediate problem.
For now, GOP leaders have moved their attention to tax reform, but they're vowing that they're not giving up on their 7-year campaign promise to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. That has Democrats worried that the GOP is once again going to try to overhaul 1/6 of the U.S. economy without any input from their party. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A Wilmington homeless shelter facing closure amid a police investigation into missing money received a reprieve today for at least 1 month. WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
For the past year, the Rick Van Story Center near downtown Wilmington has operated a 54-bed shelter for the homeless. This week, though, officials decided to close the shelter until it straightened out its financial situation. Wilmington police, along with Delaware social service officials, are trying to figure out what happened to more than $125,000 that was unaccounted for from December 2015 until early this year. But Friday morning, an anonymous donor provided a lifeline with a $10,000 gift. New Executive Director Patrick Goonan announced the donation to about 75 people who were gathered at the center for a recovery rally.
We can now use that as a challenge gift for other people to help us keep the doors open during this upcoming winter season.
Former Executive Director Alan Conover and the agency bookkeeper were ousted this spring. Police were contacted in July and began a criminal investigation. Police couldn't provide information on the status of their case Friday, but Goonan said it's clear the money didn't go to vendors or legitimate agency expenses.
They were used for other personal purposes that we're trying to figure out how and where.
The news of a reprieve came as a relief to clients like Angel Rodriguez, who was outside the center Friday morning.
It's great to hear that news. It wasn't the homeless people's fault to suspend something where people can come and sleep and feel safe. It's just not right, you know. It's too many homeless people here in Delaware.
For now, 54 people have a place to sleep. Over the next month, Goonan will look for other funders to keep the program running. From the Delaware desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
The U.S. Supreme Court returns to work Monday. The Court of Public Opinion gets underway right now. Gaveling us into session is Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, what does the public think about the U.S. Supreme Court and their work?
Well, the good news is approval rating for the Supreme Court is certainly higher than either for Congress or for the presidency. 49% approval rating, we just updated that, for the way the Supreme Court is handling its job in general. We know Congress approval is down in the teens, and presidential job approval rate now is, you know, 35 to 40% in that range. So people like the Supreme Court more than the other two branches. Compared to last year, the Supreme Court, however, jumped up, I should say, mainly because Republicans have become a lot more positive just in the period of 1 year. And that's, of course, because a Republican is now in the White House, and one conservative justice, Neil Gorsuch, was appointed to the Supreme Court. And perhaps Republicans and conservatives anticipate there may be more that can be appointed by a Republican President Donald Trump. Democrats' approval of the court is down from last year, Republicans up, but you put it all together, the Republican surge is higher, and that's why overall approval has gone up.
And with that, is the court now regarded as too liberal, too conservative?
Well, the court is now viewed as too conservative rather than too liberal, and that's a flip. During the Obama administration, we tended to see Americans saying the court was too liberal. But now that Trump has taken over, again, we've seen this big shift, and all of a sudden Democrats are telling us it's too conservative. When you put it all together, that's changed the overall numbers.
Frank, another taxing issue was in the news this week, and what do Americans think of the effort to streamline, simplify our 1040s?
I have to say one thing, Dave, right off the bat, that we don't see evidence that Americans are pushing for, desperately, so to speak, tax reform. That's not a high priority issue. With that said, based on all the data that I've reviewed, sure, Americans are willing to go along with transforming the tax code. Now, we've asked some questions over the years about reducing the number of brackets, which is one of the proposals it looks like that the Republicans and Trump are putting forward, and Americans say okay to that as well. I have to say, though, two things Americans do not want, clearly in the data, and that is more tax cuts on upper-income Americans and more tax cuts for corporate America.
Safe to say whatever bracket you're in, you're thinking you're paying too much in taxes?
Yeah, but not as much as in the past. I'll give you a precise number. 51% of Americans say that the amount of taxes they pay is too high. We ask that each year at about tax season. And, of course, that's a slight majority, but that's been considerably higher in the past, particularly before George W. Bush's tax cuts came in when he started his administration back in the early 2000s.
Folks are trying to make sense of Roy Moore's victory in the GOP primary this week in Alabama. What does it portend for elections coming up across the country?
The fact that this very right-wing former judge got nominated by the Republicans down there in Alabama in and of itself isn't shocking, because when we look at our data by state on ideology, that is, are you conservative, moderate, or liberal, asking people to define themselves, Alabama is the second most conservative state in the union. 47% of residents of Alabama define themselves as conservative. It's 49% in Wyoming. You can contrast that with the state where the fewest Americans say they're conservative, just by way of giving you some kind of context for that, and that's Massachusetts, where just 25% are conservative. So the fact that he was elected from Alabama isn't shocking.
Let's bring those labels to the tri-state region.
As is usually the case, Pennsylvania is kind of in the middle. 36% of Pennsylvania residents, and this is through all of last year, defined themselves as conservative. And as mentioned, that's right in the middle. Pennsylvania is often right in the middle. New Jersey, slightly less conservative than Pennsylvania. 31% of residents in New Jersey say they're conservative, and Delaware is 32%.
Has that moderate cohort overall in the nation changed over time?
Moderate hasn't changed so much, but in recent years, we've actually seen Americans being a little more willing to define themselves as liberal. Not as many as conservative, but the liberal label has been going up.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Last night, a short play premiered in Rittenhouse Square. It's a comedy about dying, written by someone who's dying. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on jokes that come out of hospice.
Harry Azoff is 91 years old, and he suffers from renal failure. His kidneys don't function anymore, but he's surprisingly active. He lives by himself in an apartment in Queen Village, his home of 35 years.
Death, I expect it, and when the ugly guy comes to get me, okay, so be it. I had a nice time all my life, had a good life, beautiful wife and nice kids. What else is there?
He has outlived his wife and one of his kids, but he won't outlive kidney failure. He has been in home hospice care for over a year. Most people last about 60 days.
I think for him, the process has been stressful.
That is Morgan Thompson. She's a hospice volunteer who visits Azoff once a week.
The fact that, you know, he has been on hospice for so long, and I know, at least to me, he has questioned, why am I still here? Like, I don't get, like, I'm supposed to be dying, right? Okay, so I'm ready. I'm tired. And then he may bounce back. Sometimes he bounces back right the next visit with, oh, you know, it's cool. I'm almost human today. It's his favorite joke. I'm almost human today.
Thompson and Azoff have together been making jokes about dying for a year, so they co-authored a comedy. Azoff says it does not yet have a name.
There's a little song years ago, and it said, enjoy yourself before it is too late. Enjoy yourself. Da-da-da-da. It's a nice little song. So I think maybe I'll call it Enjoy Yourself Before It Is Too Late. Do you remember that song?
Enjoy Yourself, It's Later Than You Think.
It's later than you think. That's it. That's it. It's later than you think.
The play, which was performed by a company of actors at the Penn Hospice Center in Rittenhouse Square, is about Azoff's relationship with the hospice staff.
Did you always dream of being a hospice nurse, or did it come to you in a nightmare?
The jokes are broad, mostly one-liners, between observations about dying. Azoff isn't expecting to win any awards.
I like things that slipping on a banana peel is not funny anymore, but when I was a kid, oh, you laughed like the Dickens when somebody slipped on a banana peel. Things like that.
Have you ever seen cartoon drawings of the Grim Reaper? How can anyone take that guy seriously?
Harry, that was the deepest joke I've heard in weeks. Are you implying that death is a relief?
I'm not implying anything. It's a statement of the obvious.
And there's the punchline.
Azoff is new to writing. He spent most of his life as a jeweler. After retiring, he took up painting and stained glass. His apartment is decorated with his work. All his life, he has played harmonica. In what time he has left, he also wants to learn to play the mandolin. After being in hospice for a year, Azoff knows that every day is both a gift and a burden.
That's called Let Me Go, Lover. It's an old song. You wouldn't know that song way past your time, but it was a very pretty song. Let Me Go, a heart-wrenching song, just the kind for it fit my personality.
Please turn me loose. What's the use? Let me go, lover.
Azoff may write a sequel or not. Every day he plays it by ear. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. This week, we welcome our new intern, Isabel Christo. Hi, Isabel. At the helm, Bob Alves, Charlie Kyer, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Musoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our News Director is Eugene San. Our Assistant News Director is Katie Colinari. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.
You want me to go on wanting you. I pray that you will say that.